You're now plugged in to the Delphi podcast.
What's up, guys? Welcome back to the Delphi podcast. I'm Tom Shaughnessy, and I help lead Delphi Ventures, as well as host some of the most in-the-weeds and thought-provoking guests across crypto, spanning Layer 1s to DeFi, NFTs, and beyond. The goal is to have fun, but also to dive deep and offer foundational episodes on projects and founders. Also, check out our research on Delphi Digital or miss out on the most compelling research there is. It's up to you. As a reminder, nothing said on this podcast is a solicitation to buy or sell any security or token or to make any financial decisions. Delphi Ventures may hold tokens mentioned, so check out our transparency page in the show notes for more info. With that, let's dive in. See you guys on the other side.
All right, today we're thrilled to be joined by Udav Marwaha and Alex Legend from Friction Labs. Friction is the largest structured products and portfolio management protocol on Solana. And before diving into Friction, maybe you could tell us about your backgrounds and your journeys into crypto.
Yeah, thanks for having us, guys. I'm looking forward to sharing with you guys a little bit about the space and kind of what we're working on. My name is Udav. I came into crypto in like 2017, 2018, went to school in Austin, which is also how I met Alex. I had a bunch of friends who were kind of working in the Ethereum ecosystem and starting to build projects or work with the foundation, and got kind of hooked to what they were working on. Was in a computational finance group, which is also how we met. And someone in there who was early to the Solana ecosystem also got us a lot more involved, and I encouraged us to start building in like January of last year. At that point, I was still finishing up a job as commodities trading in Chicago, worked primarily on gasoline, crude oil, and some more agriculture derivative desks. And in October, we decided to do the hackathon together and built out Friction's V1 and kind of grown a lot since then.
Yeah, I'm Alex, as you heard. Pretty similar story in terms of how we met and in college, kind of got into crypto, especially during COVID. You know, it's kind of a COVID thing, like getting pretty interested in that. And I'm already been in the trading world. So from a training perspective, like the whole setup of things from like perpetuals on centralized exchanges to like DeFi, everything that's going on in DeFi was just really fascinating. And from there, I was graduated recently, like last year, and was going to go to a full-time job, and then we had this idea for Friction and just decided we had to start it.
That's a great intro. I'm curious, were you guys like boys right off the bat in high school, or did this take a while for you guys to develop and come up with this mastermind structured products platform?
That's a good question. So we met in college through this computational finance group at UT, and then we became boys, as you were saying. And we started, we like worked on a bunch of stuff. Like I tried to get Alex to do some work with me on like tracking the flow of commodities, particularly crude oil in Texas, using like really crappy PDFs that you had to OCR to track like the Railroad Commission's data on the movement of physical like oil products to get some edge in potentially trading the physical derivatives in Texas. That's like one of the first things we worked on. And then, Alex did a bunch of stuff with like prediction markets. I think we became a lot closer during college for sure. And then, definitely like continued to crypto red pill each other. I think Alex had his fair share of time on BSC and did a lot of interesting things there, and then moved to Avalanche. And yeah, we just kept up during as COVID hit in the PAs, learning about new stuff, kind of moving out of traditional markets and then really like diving into what's going on in crypto. And it was a perfect time to get involved because we were both working from home and Alex was about to start a job doing treasuries trading. So yeah, it turned out to be a fortuitous intersection of paths, I guess.
All right. Well, before we get into what you're building with Friction, could you break down for those at home, what is a derivative and how it works?
Yes, a derivative is just any asset, like tradable asset or contract that's over like an existing asset. So it just means derivative isn't just derived from that other thing. And so the reason that's important is because like oftentimes the like a normal asset you have like you can only have like linear exposure to whatever that like price is, right? A derivative will let you like create like a non-linear or superlinear set of like payoffs, which is like sometimes really beneficial. And like you can be like it makes a lot of sense. It's like a certain allocation in a portfolio. So or like a special use case like hedging, which is like risk management for like many different use cases. So yeah, it can be really useful.
And then high level, what are you building with Friction and where do derivatives fit into that?
Yeah, I mean, I think derivatives, like the main ones that most people know are like perpetuals and like futures that trade like on centralized exchanges. And I think for us, I mean, those are still really important because like those are going to be used. They have like a lot of use cases, but we saw like our first kind of set of products as kind of like, I guess, structured products. So using kind of options to as a yield product and providing like a short vol kind of use case for users who are like seeking yield on their tokens. And so derivatives there are quite useful. And then in terms of like the other products that we're building, kind of like for the full portfolio, which is going to be like the friction portfolio, those kind of fill in the holes. So like options aren't going to cover like the gamut of everything you can do or every like yield opportunity you have. So derivatives, so I mean, I don't think every product we're going to make is a derivative. Like for example, like a borrow lend product is not a derivative. But you know, anything that can't be constructed in current DeFi and needs to be part of our portfolio will be.
And so like why is this interesting? Because I understand you can, you know, build out interesting, sophisticated hedging instruments and you get, you know, different risk exposure. But why is this interesting in the world of crypto today? Like why are derivatives something that you think are compelling enough to actually not only allocate your money and your time, your skill set and your brains towards solving this problem?
Yeah, I guess to understand why this fits into crypto, maybe we'll just review like where do, at high level, like where do yields come from in DeFi or just crypto generally, right? The iconic one, early starter of DeFi summer was money markets. So the ability to lend into a permissionless or permission pool. And then there's AMMs where you can provide liquidity into a liquidity pool, which rebalances based on the supply of assets in the pool. And in return, you earn some transaction fees or some native governance token incentives. Then there's network staking or validating. So you can in liquid stake assets like ETH or STOL with Marinade or Lido or any variety of services. And then there's derivatives arbitrage. So that's monetizing strategies like cash and carry. And then there's volatility, which is the space we started with. Volatility being you can use the volatility, the inherent volatility of an underlying asset. And again, you can just think about vol like standard deviation for the most part. And you can use that volatility to generate some premium or yield from the sale of an option or a power perpetual or any nonlinear instrument like Alex was talking about. And construct it in the right way, it takes on this very specific risk reward portfolio or profile that fits into your portfolio amongst other earn strategies. So in the history of DeFi, we've seen that the spectrum I listed was kind of in the order of complexity. And we've gone through the first four or five or the first four in the last 2 years as we've seen the rise of a bunch of AMMs, a bunch of lending protocols, a bunch of staking derivatives. And now we see that one of the more long-term sustainable forms of return generation is strategies that involve these derivative arbs or options or generally volatility as an asset class. We think that every portfolio, whether it's traditional or crypto, is either long or short volatility and has these levers that it has to manage. So without having opportunities to actively short and long vol across a bunch of assets and asset classes, you can't really have a proper portfolio that will survive across market cycles. That's really like the goal of what we're trying to build with Friction.
So historically, only products like these were being sold on centralized exchanges, but increasingly, these are available on decentralized exchanges. What are the implications of this, and why might somebody choose to go on a decentralized exchange when these are, you know, offered on something like CME?
I think it comes down to like the ease of accessibility and just like the friction, or I guess like the barriers to entry, right, for like participating in those assets or the strategies. I think on chain it's just like really simple a lot of times. So like you just have these tokens that are sitting there, and you pay this pretty low transaction fee, at least on Solana, where we're running, and you just get to participate in the vaults. And basically, like, it's all permissionless as well. So you don't have to like, you don't have to KYC, you don't have to sign up via some like complicated process. You don't have to be an institution. On CME, oftentimes, if you want to trade anything physically settled, you have to be an institution. And you know, there's like huge margin requirements for anyone, even if you're trading like cash settled futures. So really, four options. And so really, it's just like the simplicity's sake. And I think not only that, but we're actually bringing like in these like third, fourth, and fifth vaults, we're bringing products that don't even exist off-chain, or like sometimes don't even exist in DeFi at all. And so that's like particularly interesting. It's like, okay, you get this like, entirely new product. So this is the only place you can access it. So like, you know, that's kind of by definition.
Yeah, yeah. In addition to the simplicity and the kind of usable UX, I think one big thing that just DeFi generally brings is like the interoperability of various little building blocks. We call them vaults. So vaults are Friction's native structure products. And through an allocation of vaults, you can get exposure to, I think, 25 assets now that we support, and we have some of the largest option markets across CeFi and DeFi for. One thing that we also continue to see DeFi always continue to win on is like the innovation of new products. Like Alex mentioned, we don't have perps on the CME. We don't have PowerPurpose, much less on really any centralized venue. So creating these new innovative products that allow people to access return payoffs and risk profiles that they've never been able to touch in CeFi is something that I think is just inherently valuable. And we'll continue to see that in DeFi. I mean, this is one of the reasons we got into it, right? The playground to build these things is so large. And regardless of where you're doing this, I think DeFi is just going to continue to offer these benefits, and we have to build with money Legos in mind.
Yeah, only 3 of our 25 assets, I think, are on centralized exchanges. So,
yeah,
like,
which is insane.
The other 22, like, are just, you can't trade them off-chain, you know.
So the various, like, money Legos that you tap into, there's differences in the architecture. There's central limit order books. There's AMMs. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, those differences in architecture, you know, how they affect what you do at Friction?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of, like, how we access liquidity, we run, like, weekly auctions for most of our products. And with the options one specifically, it's done like kind of like a point in time. So it's like there's like a window that's people participate. They do post on an order book. Like it's filled, like the best price going kind of laddering down.
Traditional like blind Dutch auction.
Yeah, yeah. And what we see there is like, okay, well, we don't need continuous liquidity for this thing because it's like, it is a yield product. It's not. And like user, it has to do with like how much like demand users have for their flexibility with respect to like how invested they are and how long they're invested. And we've noticed like 1 week is like really not a big deal. So you actually trying to get like continuous liquidity on these things is like sometimes like negative idea. It's a bad idea because you know, it's just it's not going to be useful. And also like market makers and people that are like interested in that wouldn't be able to like won't provide as good liquidity in that like single window you actually need.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, I think we see like, and at that point, you know, if you're doing a single auction, like order books are just the most natural thing because you allow anyone to post like any price, any size, and you just like fill them as like their affinities for like that price and size. Like, you know, whoever is the highest affinity for that option is going to get the best price.
I just want to pause. Sorry, I want to pause you right there because I think we're getting a bit technical, and I just want to like hone in on, for example, like when you say auction, right? Like, what are you looking like? Who are the buyers and sellers, and what are you actually purchasing? Yeah.
Yeah. So just to rewind on what an auction is. So an auction for us is a concentrated liquidity window, like Alex mentioned, where buyers or sellers of an asset show up to participate in this transaction. For us, the way we use Channel RFQ, which is the RFQ engine behind Friction, we engage a group of 15 to 20 market makers who show up on the bid side and are participating in our fully on-chain auctions where they're putting up the bid for buying the options that are being sold by the first and second vault. Or in the case of the PowerPurpose, they're using Entropy.Trade, which is our exotic perps decks, and they're participating in the other side of the trade. So now what do we do to ensure maximum price discovery and really as efficient of a market as we can get? Well, we have to make this competitive. So we designed the auction in such a way where they have time windows in which they need to participate. And there's a very competitive atmosphere around getting the best price, since this is the market for most long-tail DeFi assets in terms of options, right? And he made a really good point about continuous liquidity being not just challenging, but also sometimes being kind of damaging in terms of the amount of edge that a maker would ask for when they want to show continuous liquidity versus provide it just in time for a strategy like Friction's Vault. So that's at a high level how our auctions work. And then we're actually going to be onboarding a couple of, or probably the largest CeFi options liquidity network in the next couple of weeks, which should definitely increase the user base and the maker base by about 700 counterparties who do like 30% of volume right now. So we tend to see a massive interest from institutions to get into these auctions as well, given their kind of stature in the DeFi options world.
Nice. Yeah, and I appreciate that. And zooming out one level above kind of where we're discussing right now at this liquidity layer, right? You mentioned, you know, the makers and takers of the world. And I think this is like a dynamic that hasn't really been quite cracked yet for crypto derivatives as a whole. And that's maybe why we haven't seen them take off as much as they have, relatively speaking, in the TradFi world. Could you maybe talk about like, who are the makers and who are the takers in crypto options today?
Yeah, so takers wise, I think there's a couple of categories. So as it's generally sold in the beginning as a yield product with a specific risk reward, the first set of users that came to Friction were traditionally like sophisticated DeFi users or power users of other DeFi protocols that have seen this opportunity show up on chain and have a relatively better risk-adjusted return than other strategies, whether it's on this chain or any other chain with those underlying assets. Then there's a second layer of more DeFi native institutions or crypto native institutions, DAOs. These DAOs have come in to get custom designed risk reward profiles across vaults. And this can comprise of large allocations from their treasury, and special proportions of capital that they've delegated to participate in the strategy. And then the newest emerging classes, off-chain institutions or traditional asset managers who are looking to get access to permission vaults. And essentially, they're looking to take the same risk profile on that they may have in other asset classes. So if they're using index overriding option strategies in CeFi that have nothing to do with crypto, and they know how to create a portfolio that also hedges the short ball, they're going to come over to a place like Friction and look for the best pricing. And then on the maker side, it's a bit more interesting.
Yeah, the maker side, what you start with is kind of like a huge number of some market makers who have kind of historically been providing liquidity, both in spot and in options. Usually OTC though, before it was like OTC and on Deribit, more centralized exchanges. And then you also have, like, now that we have these permissionless auctions that we're kind of putting up, you have like all kinds of users who just like actually want to be, who just want to buy options. Like, because most of our vaults are selling, actually all our vaults right now are selling options. And so, you know, it's operationally a little more difficult to do that through the vault, which is it's going to come out at some point, but like it's a bit harder to do as like an on-chain strategy. But oftentimes we'll see users who just want to actually own the option token and just like have the contract. And like that's interesting because then it's just like, okay, well, you know, that's maybe the most fair form of like transfer of value where we just have people meeting at the fairest price possible. You know, that's kind of what we want to happen. It's just like people meeting at mid, whatever fair value is, just exchanging that like risk payoff so that they both, you know, they're happiest with.
Yeah. And then the profile of the makers, I mean, as you mentioned, so there's traditional makers who can hedge their exposure on exchanges with like Delta One instruments like PERPs. And then there's volatility arbitrage desks who are putting on relative value trades between, let's say, an altcoin vault here or ETH vault there. And then there's just funds that have mandates to be long vol or to be hedged with other positions that come in and try to access these auctions. And then there's like an emerging class, as you said, of once the auctions are fully permissionless, anyone should be able to bid in this auction and increase the competitiveness, which is something you're looking forward to.
Nice. And then, well, like, what would be the alternative if you wanted to sort of like build something like Friction? Would you have to do it on like an on-chain options market? I mean, if you didn't want to go like this,
probably use Telegram.
Telegram.
Most people use Telegram, to be honest. Like, they use Telegram, and then the owner of the protocol, the core devs, just transfer the option token to the winner of the auction, and it shows up in their wallet. And it's a pretty non-DeFi native process. We started off not wanting to do that, right? So we definitely don't want to revert back to something like that.
So what percent of the market do you think is running on that right now, of the option, crypto's options market? Is it running on Telegram, Discord, market making?
Oh, that's a great question. Yeah. I mean, in the DeFi world or in the CeFi world?
Well, both respectively.
Probably a lot of the CeFi, a lot of the OTC CeFi, because like OTC is typically done Telegram. Like if it's not on Deribit, then, and it's not in Paradigm, then it'd probably be like on Telegram. But in DeFi, I mean, the two biggest vaults, vault programs basically don't use Telegram anymore. So I would say probably not most of the TVL is not, but you know, I don't know, maybe there's some of these smaller protocols probably, yeah. But definitely like, you know, if you look like even 3 months ago, 6 months ago, it was like, yeah. Or maybe six months ago, it was like mostly Telegram, right?
Yeah, I would say it would have been like greater than 6 months ago, it was 75-80%, if not more, of DeFi options were traded by OTC Telegram chats. And I mean, right now Paradigm has like 30% market share, which is crazy because like they're doing clearly largest volume. So there's definitely a lot of the market out there that's still doing these things OTC. Not to say that OTC systems are the most inefficient. Like if you compare these three forms of pricing, like a AMM, a order book, and an RFQ system, each one has very interesting trade-offs. And for doing large sizes of somewhat illiquid instruments, I think RFQs will continue to dominate. And we'll have to improve on auction design and mechanism, maybe as much as we've had iterations on AMM design. Actually, I think like Dan Robinson was posting about this on Twitter the other day. He's like, I think AMM research is like somewhat at a glass ceiling, which is great because like now we need to improve on how we like design auctions and how we get liquidity for these somewhat complicated instruments.
So are you totally bearish on like option AMM designs or, and you think the future are these RFQ or order book models?
I would say bearish, bearish passive market making. Yeah. On that. Yeah. Definitely passive. Bearish passive market making on, what we want to do is basically match, just find all the buyers, find all the sellers, just match them at fair value. And like, then they're both like makers and also takers in a way. Like it's hard to classify. They're both kind of providing liquidity to each other. Like neither one is kind of like saying, oh, well, I'm like a little bit less willing to participate in this, so therefore I'm gonna like, I'm actually like the maker, you know. It's like, no, it's like more like, okay, well, they just both really want, one really wants to buy an option, one really wants to sell an option. Let's just find what the fair value is and meet there. And like, that's what we're gonna do. Long, that's the long-term plan here. And that's like, so, and that way, I guess you kind of, I mean, it's kind of ambiguous, but I mean, that's kind of the perfect world, right? It's like, well, you don't, you skip any middlemen and you just have that.
Yeah. And so why does the passive, why are the passive models no good? Like, is it because liquidity is fragmented over strikes and expirations? Is that it? Or is it something else?
I think it's not clear that like, you're basically, when you deposit an OMM, so you have like make an OMM and you like provide liquidity to it. I mean, you're not really saying I want to buy options or I want to sell options. Like, you're really making the statement I want to provide liquidity for options, which is then saying, okay, well, now you're making a claim that like your strategy you're using is good. Like, okay, well, I have to be a good market. I don't have to be bullish, like vol, long vol. I don't have to be long beta, short beta, short vol. I have to like have a good like market making strategy, because I don't know whether I'm going to be buying or selling. Like, I'm just going to have the position that people don't want, you know, on average. So it's like, okay, is the passive OMM like typically good at that? Like, no. And we have on chain, like if you look at Unity 3, like, I mean, you just like, you see like, okay, well, passive market makers typically are not good at that. And options even more so than spot, because like, okay, well, this is a more complex product. It actually requires like active hedging, like with perps or like, or with other options. And it's just like, it becomes quite complex to do that. So yeah, I think we're just like, that's generally like, that's a passive strategy is not going to work well for options market making. But if you have like a direction you want to take, like a long vol, short vol, and you just like are able to match them, like that's going to be like a much more efficient process where everyone's happy, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, most OMMs or most implementations of options AMMs, the LPer is basically putting on a short covered call or a cash secured put, and it's just not as evident when they're doing that most of the time. I mean, as you said, like the position can change without you necessarily knowing, but yeah, you have to take the other side of what the market wants since you're providing passive liquidity. Which makes it tricky because, as you said, strikes and expiries have to be handled and liquidity has to be distributed amongst all of these, which is why we're so excited about power perps and nonlinear perps, because they capture this strikeless and expiryless option type payoff.
So let's dive a little bit more into what you're building with Friction. I guess high level, what does Friction do when it takes all these on-chain derivatives and structures them into a vault? Is it as simple as writing like an equation or something? Or like, could you walk us through what happens when you're creating a vault from scratch?
Yeah, so we kind of have this like overarching generic like template for a vault, which is like, okay, well, typically epoch based, doesn't have to be, but like, you know, if you look at an AMM, typically it's like instant withdrawal deposit, because you know the exact value of the vault at any point in time, so you know exactly how much how many share tokens they have, like how much the user owns, and like liquidity doesn't need to, it's not locked up in an investment, right? It's just like instant liquidity, and so they can withdraw. With an investment or like a trading strategy, it's typically not as simple, because like, either you don't actually know what the value of the vault is at any point in time. Like, maybe you don't have a fair market price for the assets that it's holding. Or two, like maybe it has to be locked up in some kind of contract, right? As collateral, or maybe you've like purchased something. So like, yeah. So basically we have a generic kind of epoch structure where it's like people can deposit, withdraw, and it kind of has this whole like, state management for people's deposits, withdrawals, and balances. And then so that's kind of the overlay on every vault. And then with underneath that, we kind of think about, okay, well, how does this like next component, like what's the highest marginal value add for like our existing portfolio of vaults? And then like, okay, how do we actually construct that payoff, right? So, okay, well, maybe we're missing like a downside vault hedge, right? Like that's like something that should be in every portfolio. It should be like, you know, like I guess a put's like the classic example of this. Like you have a bunch of like long beta typically, and you want to like hedge yourself in a downside, like today, like a day like today, right? And so, okay, like how do we replicate that in the most like efficient way? Maybe puts aren't the best way to do that. Like, what is this like? Okay, well, like maybe you draw it. It looks like, you know, exponential, like a reverse exponential curve. Like, how do you replicate it the best possible way? Like with like the least operational risk and get like the best value and the best price. And so like, that's typically how we'll start, and then kind of like explore the gamut of existing products. Okay, like what exists? Like, you know, I mean, I guess like honestly, Paradigm publishing some of those assets is really interesting. Like those are something we look at typically, or like we'll look at like what we know from TradFi. Or like typically, and honestly, like we kind of like puts are a pretty good one to begin with. But and anyway, so from there we'll kind of like go and actually just figure out how to price the thing. So once we have the assets, like how do we price this in the best possible way? Who can we like guarantee to be on to provide liquidity or to be there? And like how can we match like the buyers and sellers who most want to participate in this? And so, yeah, I think that's typically how we approach it. I don't know if you have anything to add to that.
Yeah, that was really good. I mean, the epoch dimension is one thing that's really important. So how do you create like a time window in which this trades? Then there's like the price dimension. So how do you get the best price? And how do you have efficient price discovery through this auction mechanism? And then there's a strategy level, which is what is the payoff we're targeting with the strategy? And how can we ensure that the performance is as close to that payoff as was described? and then prioritizing which new strategies to add in. So our vaults, the first one is a call overwrite. The second one's a put overwrite. The third one is a delta hedged power perpetual position. So it's like replication in TradFi is probably like a rebalancing, a daily rebalancing fixed strike at the money straddle. So it's essentially like selling a call and a put at some discrete point that lasts for the length of the epoch. So the first three are like vol harvesting strategies. And then our most recently launched product, which is a basis yield vault, essentially can be long or short basis, which is one of the derivatives arbitrages we were talking about earlier, which is the difference between spot and a perp, or maybe spot and expiratory future once that market gets liquid. We want strategies that both take market like outlooks and also are market neutral in the sense that they may have minimum delta, or at least the delta is very like modelable. And then we also want fixed income strategies. So with some of the vaults coming out in the future, we want the user to be able to access streams of reliable institutional lending liquidity or borrowing liquidity to be able to lock in fixed or variable or fixed rates, or even have exposure to kind of variable rates if that's something that they desire. And then you can combine all of these to create this pretty epic combination of portfolios that you can test out and see how they perform in at a sample and do back tests on them to really create whatever your portfolio imagines. Yeah.
Now, I'm realizing I should be asking you guys and talking with you more frequently on like portfolio, you know, construction, because you know you're throwing out, you know, a lot of these interesting strategies like vol harvesting and taking, you know, market neutral trades and et cetera. And I'm wondering, like, do you guys have any opinions of your own? Like, why at me as an relatively speaking unsophisticated crypto investor, who, you know, prefers to hold sort of unhedged positions with lots of upside, right? If I'm trying to transition into this world of more like sophisticated, complex portfolio construction, like where should I be dipping my toes in first? Is it like, you know, how do I understand what vol harvesting is and why is it important to me?
Yeah. So I think this is also a process we go through quite frequently with DAOs and institutions that participate in circuits, which is Friction's on-demand portfolio management system that essentially you go to the page, so app.friction.fi/circuits, and you click on the info button to apply for the circuit. And we ask everyone for some similar information. I think these risk reward metrics, everyone who wants to create a portfolio should be aware of. So we ask for a couple of things, and this is probably like a good platform for what you should have to classify or quantify about your portfolio before you start to take risk. So the first one is obviously like, what's your target annualized return? What's your max drawdown that you can tolerate in a month, in 6 months, in a year? What's your liquidity profile? So how quickly do you need to be able to get in and out of a position? And that determines the allocation of the resources. And then also like what your working capital needs, or like how much income do you need to generate on a monthly basis if you're a DAO or your individual, for your like livelihood. So if you need to hire people, you need to manage your working capital generation. If you can't tolerate 25% drawdown, then you shouldn't be 100% in shortfall. We need to answer a bunch of these questions before we can say like, this is how we could think about building a portfolio. And then the next step for us is always like, take the data that we have from all these like liquid vol markets, backtest them, stress test them, and perform some base risk analysis to say like, these are potential allocations that your strategy, that you could have had into strategies, and this is how they would have performed over time. Obviously, like no backtest is 100% true into the future. And then we take that part and then we'd like talk to people about it. I mean, same thing we'd do if you were a DAO applying to circuits, talk to them about how that would distribute risk. Where do you sit on the DeFi efficient frontier, as we like to call it, which is essentially just a risk reward spectrum. And then, yeah, and then just like plan out how to be prepared for market moving against your portfolio, how you would resize or take risk off the table. And then introduce this like component of dynamic risk management, which is actually like really good book that definitely everyone should read. But it essentially talks about how you handle risk during adverse events like what we're seeing in the market right now. How can you potentially get out of positions? How can you minimize drawdown while things are going crazy? Which is the long vol component that Alex alluded to earlier.
Gotcha. So just to kind of like take actionable insight here, on a day like today, for example, right, where I'm usually sitting just long crypto, what kind of instruments should I be holding in my portfolio to kind of hedge that downside exposure?
Yeah, I think the user flow for you would go something like this. Like, you basically say like, hey, I want to be like extremely long beta, but I also don't want to be like really sad when things go really down. And I want to make sure like, yeah, I want to be long beta, but if like in a black swan event, I want to like be hedged, you know, kind of thing. I want to have like, you know, maybe half my downside to be hedged if things go terribly. And so it's like, okay, well, you know, the things that kind of fit that, I guess, description are like puts, maybe like an inverted like kind of reverse crab vault. So like kind of like the, if you, not a short crab, but like a long crab vault. So it's like, actually you're kind of like long straddle, but it's on a continuous basis.
Square root perps, which are going to be pretty cool. They haven't been seen in the wild yet, but that would be a pretty cool instrument to potentially give you like put option, like payoff with perpetual like funding rates.
Yeah, it's not anything that has like a negative delta and that has like a R squared component. So like, or anything like any like exponent greater than one, right, on R.
Something
so
really like, convex it's not to protect
like,
your downside.
Super linear. Yeah. So basically, and that's like, and like, yeah, it depends exactly how much. Like maybe you want to say, I'm okay with everything going down like 30%. And, you know, so maybe there's like some threshold at which you kind of want to be hedged.
Okay, guys, that was a lot to digest. A lot of valuable information, but I think we need to break down step by step a few of these terms and concepts. Can we run through them real quick?
So let's just say like you hold a linear product. So you own a product where if the market goes up a dollar, you make a dollar. If the market goes down a dollar, you lose a dollar. So this is, yeah, we just call it a delta one instrument. So like a future spot or a perp, depending on, yeah, you can do some interesting things with leverage to change that exposure a bit. But most people are just sitting on this. So then your payout is like one plus R. So that's how when you trade a perp, you can track your P&L. And then with existence of like nonlinear instruments, so let's take a power two perp, your payoff is now one plus R, the whole thing squared. So you break that down, do a little math. So you have R squared plus two R plus one. So remember we said delta one products just are tracking R, right? So that two R component is just delta that you can hedge using a linear instrument like a perp. And then the R squared term, which is really interesting, is expected variance. They essentially like how much the asset can move in a day or move in some period of time. And then square root of variance is volatility, which is the key pricing mechanism behind an option. So with the power two perp in the example used, you can take that R squared component to create this really interesting convex payoff that looks like a straddle if it's hedged on the delta side. And now this is a different world than the beta world where Alex can share some more.
So beta is just kind of similar to like the market. I would say beta is like you choose, like when you're like constructing a portfolio, you're thinking about what you want to invest in. It's usually like an index you're kind of comparing against. Like BTC is the obvious one for crypto and ETH sometimes. And so like the L1 that you're on maybe. So yeah, well, beta is basically, okay, what is your kind of a correlation or exposure, linear exposure to like that instrument. And so I would say like beta instruments is like basically the kind of the series of instruments like perps, futures, spot that is like very closely related to like BTC or ETH or SOL, whatever is that, whatever your like benchmark is. And even like these like smaller cap coins, you know, that maybe 10x in like a bull run or 20x in the bull run, maybe more. Like they're still like linearly related, right? They still don't have like, they're maybe like a direct multiple of how much BTC goes up. Like maybe they're like 5x of what BTC goes up, but they're still going to be like linear with it, right? They're not going to have, like if BTC goes up 2x, they're going to go up 2x. If BTC goes up 5x, they're going to go 5x. But if you have like a nonlinear instrument, so something that's not just directly beta, you're going to have like if BTC goes up 2x, it might go up 2x. But if BTC goes up 5x, it might go up like 25x, you know? So it's like the idea here. Yeah, so that's a beta anyway. That's the idea of beta. And what we see is like most people like in crypto, or just any asset class, kind of want like beta exposure to the asset. Like, the reason you're there is because you're bullish that thing. Like you're really interested in that thing and you want to be part of it. So everyone wants to hold like some long crypto typically, you know, like on average. And then the question is like, how can you, but you don't want to be like directly holding long crypto because maybe it's too much risk. And so the question is like, how do you best manage that? And how do you like fit, you know, add like hedges from the down, depending on like what you think might happen in the future and like make it. So basically you have like, I guess your optimal, investment portfolio.
Gotcha. So just to try and attempt to summarize what you said, right? Beta is essentially the correlation factor between the assets or the portfolio that you're holding and the reference asset of the market at the time, which is usually like Bitcoin or the underlying L1 asset. And then, and so I might construct a portfolio of like altcoins and different assets that have maybe like a high beta correlation to, you know, major assets, but you know, I want to be able to protect myself if like, you know, the beta assets of the market, the Bitcoins, the ETH L1s, just completely dump, right? I want to be able to hedge myself against that, right? And so that's where these strategies come into play. Does that make sense?
So I'd say, so not only is it a hedge, but these strategies are also uncorrelated. So like you have a portfolio,
gotcha.
Like beta's not, so there's like different sources of return. beta is like, beta is kind of a positional drill. It's kind of like you have an opinion about something, right? Like this thing on typically when people talk about BTC, you're gonna say it's like an EV of zero, like close to zero. When you talk about just a generic asset like S&P 500 or just like a random stock market index, BTC, a lot of people are like, if you think it's gonna go up a lot, then like your expected value of how much it's gonna go up is like now positive. So you should have some weighting of that, but you might be wrong. And so you should have like if in a portfolio, like to kind of you to get like the optimal portfolio, you're actually supposed to have like many uncorrelated things, like unrelated sources of return. And then you can like weight them in the way that kind of makes most sense, where you're kind of like maximizing for EV versus like the volatility of it. And so yeah, basically what we see is like, yeah, maybe you want to be long beta. You should have definitely some allocation, maybe a large allocation. But you should also have things that are like relatively uncorrelated. Like RLN is going to be pretty uncorrelated to that, like pretty unrelated to beta. It's going to be like a consistent, maybe you're just like lending USDC. You're going to get like on average like 6-7% a year. And that's just like going to be terminal, you know, like for a while, at least for now. Maybe you're gonna like maybe short vol like a short vol component when you're like selling options, like that's gonna be like a yield. These are gonna be like somewhat unrelated things, and so like you're gonna want some of those as well. But like with respect to the beta exposure you have, you're gonna want to hedge that as well, because you also like, and all these things might have beta, like being short vol might have beta, and it typically does, because volatility actually has like a beta as well. It is like it's closely related to like how whether BTC goes up or down, but it's not exactly, it's not the same thing, you know. Maybe it's like an overlap of 50%.
And this is like one of the hardest markets in history, after talking to a lot of TradFi people as well, to trade around this concept of like beta and correlation. Because, I mean, you look at like NASDAQ versus BTC for the last 30 days, it looks like you're trading the same instrument. And then sometimes it looks like BTC is trading like 5x levered NASDAQ futures. So in markets where correlations are strong, it becomes even harder to find this diversification, which ends up being one of the catalysts for like crazy events in which everything has to move together. And when people unwind large positions, they're doing it across a basket of assets that it's really tough to be protected on, which causes illiquidity on the other side of the trade. So let's say you were long vol going to this and you're trying to exit, it makes it a little bit more challenging for you. But then there's also this issue of like how much of this beta in crypto comes from leverage. Like you could make an argument that this like 6-7% fixed rate on stable lending is largely driven by leverage, which comes from people putting on the basis trade, which we've seen compressed by like 6% on BTC or 6% on ETH and like 3% on BTC annualized this year so far, which just shows like leverage is leaving the system and the curve is flattening a little bit. So at the end of the day, it's really important to measure like how much risk your portfolio wears against the rest of the indexes, and also how much it depends on leverage being in the system to perform as a yield strategy, if that's what it is.
That's interesting. And I wanna kind of dive into that, the correlation of the state of the crypto markets today, because everything moves as one, and I'm experiencing that right now. Today's May 9th. For our viewers who are listening to this post editing, what do you think? Like, do you think the crypto markets we end up seeing like decoupling between these assets? And I guess like there's the decoupling of Bitcoin and ETH and all kind of the other altcoins, call them, and as well as crypto as a whole, and sort of like the major, ETF instruments and SPY and NASDAQ, et cetera. Do you think like either of those respective correlations decouple anytime soon?
A first take would be, at least on the macro perspective, probably not. I mean, we're seeing BTC become more and more macro related and driven by like interest rates, which is also a heavy factor. And obviously bonds, but also like equities. So, I mean, I haven't looked at correlations recently, to be honest. I've been mostly focused on debt, but I mean, my first take would be that it's going to continue like to just become more and more mainstream until it like looks very similar to the benchmarks of other markets. I think interest rates, yeah, are going to be like the biggest driver in the short term for sure. Like that's going to be huge. I mean, like, and I think it's everyone knows that already. Like,
yeah,
everyone knows that. Yeah.
I mean, just like look at how ETH vols traded going into the FOMC. And this is 7-day at the monies. The rest of the curve was kind of moving with it, but not that much. And then the moment the results came, ETH vols crashed, maybe like 5, 10 vol. And then within the next day, they came back up and kind of mean reverted, which just goes to show like there's a lot of macro players who are inside the Bitcoin market and the ETH market, particularly on the option side too, or the vol side, that are trading FOMC like it's a normal Bitcoin or ETH impacting event. Yeah, I agree with Alex. I think like more people who are coming into this space with traditional commodities or equities or fixed income backgrounds are going to start to try to treat these as somewhat similar instruments. And then this correlation will lead to like the traditional reflexivity of vol markets, which makes a lot of trading opportunities. It also leads to a lot of like tail risks for vol sellers all the time. So something that we need to launch soon.
The correlation is probably going to detach a little bit, I think, with respect to alts and crypto and the benchmarks like BTC ETH versus like you know, altcoins on the various L1s. And it's like, okay, well, maybe then, like, okay, well, if you're a user, like, maybe you have a mandate to hold those tokens, like, what do you do? Like, how do you, like, make it? Maybe, like, making yield via calls is, like, a way to compensate for any, like, bleed on those tokens. Like, we're going to see a bleed on those relative to, like, the benchmarks, right? If, like, because they're most affected by interest rates. They're kind of, like, small caps in the equity world.
Yeah, like, who's going to bid for, like, random DeFi tokens on
L1s? Liquidity disappears when you, like, if interest rates spike, right? So it's, like, okay, well, maybe you have a mandate to hold them, so what do you do with them? Or, like, if maybe you just disagree with us, and, like, okay, well, how do you, or disagree with the market, and maybe you think they're going to outperform. That's where if someone has, like, just a disagreement with what the mainstream view is, we still want to support that, like, perspective, right? And have some strategy for them. So, yeah, I think that's, like, kind of the goal there, is, like, okay, well, it doesn't matter. I mean, the correlations, like, from a friction perspective, like, the correlations aren't as important as, like, providing all the tools to construct what you want, right? It's more about, like, okay, if you're a user, if you have no opinion, okay, we'll give you what you think is the best, what we think is the best, but if you have an opinion, like, you can still just fit it in.
So a lot of people have been predicting that this year we'll see just, like, low volatility that will be kind of ranging sideways for a lot of the year. Is this a positive catalyst for structured products and crypto? You know, how do you see the market developing if that's the case? Obviously, things are dumping today, you know, pretty vertically, but for the year so far, it has been fairly horizontal. How does this play out for, you know, folks like you all?
There's like two distinct vol regimes this year so far. There's like pre March 15th FOMC meeting and post. And since then, you've seen like vols just kind of capitulate across all the main assets. Now we're starting to see things change a little bit, but like who knows if these are long-term sustainable things. So I think for like, obviously for vol selling strategies, when vol is depressed, your yields aren't going to be as great, which is why it's important to us, as Alex was saying, like we want to have these vaults to be like building blocks of a portfolio. So short vol is just one component of a structured product, right? It has to be complemented with other things in order to survive events like today and events like we're probably going to see more and more in as like fiscal policy is confusing. But yeah, I think you need the non-short vol exposure like we've been chatting about.
In terms of structured products in general, I think we're going to see them mature quite a bit. We're going to see like really good pricing on them, I think, in like three to six months. Like just like they're going to be as efficient as they can, pretty efficient, like pretty mature. I'm expecting like even if there is like a long-term bear market, I think it's actually not too bad for structured products as a whole because like it's going to be one of the few like relative like say sources of yield that kind of keeps APY. Relatively, like even if vols do drop a ton, still gonna have like you can play with the deltas, or the APY is still not gonna drop that much. It's still gonna be like higher than a lot of relative like yield farming or comparison, like anything you can compare it to that kind of like tanks in a bear market. So I think you're gonna see it actually do like okay, and I would expect it to like TVL to grow definitely. Like I'm definitely bullish structured products for sure.
I mean, we talked about five different forms of earning or yield in DeFi, and like the first three are, I mean, you can only emit a certain amount of some token. And in a market where that thing is like screamingly like long beta, then that those emissions go to zero pretty quickly and it just becomes a race to the bottom like we're familiar with in most liquidity provisioning scenarios. Lending, it's interest rate driven, which is leverage driven. So like structured products, which are vol driven, have a lot more capability to withstand these like cycles, I think.
And where do you see like a lot of demand for these structured products coming from? And you mentioned a while ago, and I'm kind of like giving you a leading question. So I want you to talk about the circuits, right? And what that means for DAOs and these on-chain entities who are holding massive amounts of tokens that you were, I think, alluding to or referring to earlier as mandates to be held. How can these DAOs leverage structured products to manage their risk exposures?
Yeah, so circuits is like one of the most exciting things I think we're working on here. And to rewind on what a circuit is, essentially the same exercise we went to mentally here, but we do it on paper for everyone who's interested in participating. It gives a DAO the chance to have people who are not, like most DAOs do not have people who are comfortable with like risk management or asset management or portfolio construction and don't have the internal tools to do backtesting, stress tests, and like groups to have these discussions in. So one thing is we want to create a platform for any DAO to be able to access these type of tools. And then within circuits, most DAOs who are participating, and just generally most DAOs in Solana and Ethereum, are in like 80 to 95% native token. And Alex mentioned earlier, like most native tokens are just beta to the L1, and they're even traded that way by funds and whoever does most of the liquidity for them. So for them, one thing they need to do is diversify, which is super obvious from a high level. But most people, when you talk to them, are like, I don't want to sell this native governance token to get into USDC, although it is a very valid form of diversification. It has like negative signal impacts to their community. So What are some ways they can use their native token, if it's slightly liquid or not liquid at all or super liquid, to generate income? So one strategy we look at is, if you're a DAO that's participating and you have a liquid native token, and we can classify this on how much spot volume there is that's not washed, how much purpose volume there is, and how many exchanges this thing is traded on. That's another reason I think we are able to list so many of these assets, is like we run a pretty like robust way to figure out if these assets can participate in surrogates. So then after risk classification, we decided what percentage of each vault it would make sense for that DAO or that person treasury to allocate into. And then we show them results. This is mostly like a quantitative process, just like sit down and go through what these weightings would look like, and then talk to the DAO and figure out how they're thinking about it from their perspective. A ton of education, so getting people familiar with the same terms that we're talking about. And for most people in DeFi, like I think they have more experience on like the D than the Fi side. So a lot of the explanation comes with like building out just standard, what we're going to call in the future, Friction Learn. So it's an education platform / academy that you can go to if you've never touched DeFi before, or you're not really super comfortable with like financial products, to get an idea of what you may be accessing with a circuit. And then maybe Alex can talk about like how we think about allocating between four strategies that we have right now.
Yeah, I think what we see is like, in terms of like if they want to keep, like, I mean, it's probably what the DAO wants to do, but I mean, typically we'd recommend like converting some of the native token into either this, like selling calls in there or using in some yield strategy, just converting it to like a non-native token asset and then like using it in any of the vaults that provide yield like on that. So like USDC is an easy one. Like even the most recent two vaults are both USDC based. And like really, yeah, that's kind of, I think, how we'd suggest that. I mean, typically the vaults that we have right now, I mean, sorry, the DAOs that we have right now in circuits are typically participating in vault 1, 2 and four. I think it's one, yep. 2 and 4 is kind of what we're seeing. So kind of like that would be like the selling puts, selling calls, and then like our basis strategy as well. So these are all kind of like basis strategy. And so these are all kind of like relatively like average yield, but like kind of like low risk products that like kind of make sense for the DAO. You know, they're just kind of sitting on these funds and they don't know, you know, they kind of got to use it for something. And, you know, I think that's kind of what we suggest. I think long term, probably be like relatively equal weighted across the vaults we have, you know, but it depends on what the DAO wants, needs.
And then there's a lot of use case specific circuits that get created, and circuits have this interesting influence on Friction, because once you work with individual DAOs and you understand what their approach to treasury management is and help them even create some if they don't have one, you start to see like what are some inherent protocol risks that they take on. Just to use one example, UXD, which is an algo stable on Solana that essentially uses a short basis position to mint a stable coin, currently just using Mango Markets. They naturally have treasury bleed when basis or when funding rates are negative. And as we've talked about, our long basis strategy takes the direct opposite position. So you can be long basis with this treasury strategy, which now gives someone who may be bullish on UXD as a protocol succeeding a chance to hedge by also taking the other side of the trade that's being put on. If for example, most of the open interest on Mango, let's say, comes from this short basis position, then inherently like there is some EV to be captured by someone taking the other side. And we create these strategies based on what we see. So UXD had a lot of demand. I think at some point, like Treasury was losing 120K a day, which on a 50 million Treasury doesn't last more than 2 years. So it needs some natural hedging mechanism that we can build. And it helps us make a really like valid use case for what we're working on or what vaults we're shipping, because the customers we're working with say like, oh, we need this. This would help ensure the stability and scalability of our product. So,
and I'm curious, what about on the retail side of things? Like what, I mean, the covered calls and puts is like the classic DeFi crypto structured product, and you know, there's plenty of competitors, right? Even on Solana, who are covering this. And so I'm curious, like, is it been the DAOs that have given you the boost to rise to kind of the top or most or highest TVL structured products platform on Solana, or is it something else that has sort of differentiated you from your competitors?
That's a good question. I think that's been a contributing factor. I think there's also two big things. So one is the education and community content work we put in before launching strategies. This is like when we were on DevNet. We created a really interesting kind of incentive scheme around our OG NFT collection called the Lightning OGs, which you can get on Magic Eden to access kind of a private community within Friction who are really early power users and have been fans of the protocol since. I think now we have like 1,700, 1,800 active holders. Of the Lightning OGs who That was like one entry point. And then a second huge part was like, how do we encapsulate like the best UX possible for this strategy, right? And like, this is something that we're not really competing against DeFi for, to be honest. We're competing against like CeFi institutions that have created like really cool looking slide decks to encapsulate institutional capital and smart retail into these call or put over right strategies. And then complementing that with like really in-depth analytics. Like I think we tend to have some of the best and most insightful analytics that are offered in DeFi right now when it comes to like covered call, put strategies, or really any of our vaults going forward. And we want to be super transparent about P&L from the strategy, the risks that a user is taking on, and then how can they go and evaluate performance week by week and track all these things on chain. So I think those are like four big components. Anything?
Not too much. I would say like one thing is just like we're shipping pretty fast in terms of what we need. And if someone wants like a product and like they're really like looking for a product, they will just ship it on kind of like relatively quickly. I think that's kind of an attractive thing. Like for some of the DAOs in our circuits, like it's like there's definitely a customizable factor to it. It's not just, we don't just have a roadmap to just ship that. Like there's also whatever the DAOs want. Like it's kind of like it's useful. Obviously, there's like a kind of positive sum relationship there.
Well, another differentiation you guys have is the RFQ system. Could you talk a little bit more about how that works and how that differentiates the liquidity you bring on Friction?
Yeah, so we talked about how the mechanism was kind of designed, like how do the auctions work a little bit earlier. In terms of how we create a liquidity network that contributes to like one of Friction's network effects, I think it's, I think a lot of it just comes from like, I think we know how to communicate with some of these players who have been who are trading firms. I mean, coming from the trading world, like RFQ process is something that I'm pretty familiar with, Alex is super familiar with. A lot of people on our team have done them for NASDAQ, NYSE, Platts, treasuries. So in terms of like communicating, I think that's like one thing as well, is we've been able to like iterate on feedback that we've gotten from market makers, which may have been different from what we would have seen in TradFi. And that's like, I think that's allowed us to get to like 15, 20 market makers now. Yes, what else could we add to that?
Well, I'm just curious, like what is the onboarding process look like? If you are approaching like an old school market maker, you might be realistically the first time they've ever touched tokens, right? So yeah, how much handholding goes into that?
Yeah, it's actually a really seamless process. We've gone through this flow like 15 times. So we've tried to make it as easy as possible for someone to onboard. We just have a part of the website that's for market makers or for anyone bidding on these auctions. And to access that, you get a whitelist token. And once you have the whitelist token, you can bid on Friction auctions. It takes like less than a couple minutes to set up. We go through the structure of how the options are designed. So in some cases, European cash settled, some cases American physically settled. We go through how the auction process itself would work in terms of the schedule, when the assets are trading. Usually it actually takes like less than 5 minutes to onboard a new market maker. I mean, with the next generation of market makers like Jane Street, HRT, Cumberland, who are not traditionally like crypto native, I would say, we're bringing on, when we bring on these guys, like the process is a little bit more focused on how do we solve some of the institutional concerns like custody and KYC, which is like a next gen Friction product. So permission vaults for these type of institutions to engage with each other directly on the platform. That's where it's taken a little bit more resource recently, because the rate at which Solana has grown has outpaced the rate at which custodians can support SPL tokens, which hasn't really happened on scale yet, right? And that's something that, I mean, people always say like institutions are coming. I mean, how can they come without access to like safe MPC or whatever their requirement is? So that's something we're putting a lot of time into now. We're growing out an institutional sales team around this. So if you're interested, listening to this, interested in building kind of like the future of CeFi, DeFi, institutional products, then yeah, hit us up. There's a lot of work we have to do in this space to onboard these traditional institutions.
So I think like a lot of people in TradFi that understand that derivatives are huge in terms of notional value. But today, like crypto options as a percentage of spot, it's about 2% in U.S. equities. The number is about 35 times that, as Jump has noted in that famous blog post. So obviously these are nascent markets, but like, why don't you think crypto derivatives have caught up, and you know, will they soon catch up, or you know, what do you see the market developing?
Well, crypto options specifically, or any derivative?
I think just crypto derivatives broadly. Like, will crypto derivatives, you know, grow and grow, or is there something that's like inherently, is there something inherent to the crypto market structure today that's kind of holding it back?
Well, if we start from the beginning, I guess, like you have like perps were the first derivative in a way, right? And those are massive actually in crypto. And like they kind of fit the retail, I mean, the role that options and TradFi play for retail, except in crypto, and that like to provide like leverage, easy leverage, and like easy, like basically like massive, like kind of oversized exposure to downside or upside, depending on like relative to how much capital you have. And so like options are typically that, like if you look at Robinhood and like option buying on there, obviously like GME, AMC, et cetera. Perps kind of fit that role in crypto, I would say. Like, and not just that role, but that's like one role they play. So you kind of like, you've seen like historically at least, like there hasn't been a need for options because that exists. And that doesn't exist in the TradFi world. What I would say is that options as a yield product have not been seen in crypto until recently, in the last like year and a half. So that's kind of something, and that's kind of something that's been growing consistently. And then also like other derivatives in general are kind of like now just coming, maybe like the past year probably have been kind of becoming like relevant, been talked about.
Yeah.
I think we see that as growing more because like obviously everyone in crypto is maturing. The number of users like entering is becoming a lot higher now. And what we're seeing is like the typical ways to get yield are not as simple anymore. Like you can't just deposit on the compound to get like a huge yield. You can't just like provide an AMM and expect that you're going to like be extremely profitable and have like a huge beta exposure. Like what we're seeing is that the oftentimes the strategies actually like are seeing like negative returns sometimes and or like close to zero returns. And so it's like kind of subpar for what like people in crypto are looking for. So you kind of have to like move like along this very spectrum, kind of move to something that either you kind of distorts your payoff differently so that you have a yield, but maybe you're like kind of letting something go, or you're accepting some like downside risk in return, or you just have like better portfolio management in general. So maybe you can just like have a completely positive sum kind of setup where you just like actually just set your portfolio better, like you have like a lower variance relative to the expected value you have. And that's kind of what our mission is, I guess.
Yeah, there's also the side of capital efficiency just not being that great in DeFi right now. I mean, as we've talked about, like our first two strategies are fully collateralized. I think there's a lot of there's a new set of risks to take on with like levered option selling. It's not something that we see as like a highly demanded product, especially like on scale. Potentially like we've like been through cycles of leveraging and deleveraging in crypto. And I think like just giving ourselves beta to that is not something we want to do as a protocol. Like we want users to have access to like strategies to survive when there's a massive deleveraging. Rather than kind of go with the tide. I think margining is something that we'll see take more of a bigger role. So you can use your balances on one DEX against another DEX, and we're seeing a bunch of approaches to generalize leverage working. And also, as Alex mentioned, like structured products in DeFi are like not even 2 years old at this point. And as we're talking about, they're just pretty vanilla. So we just have to continue innovating things that people will find. And especially like during continuous like down markets, I think gives us a lot of time to like sit down and focus and say like, what are people going to like? And if it worked in a bear market, then I think like it should probably have proven the test of some really aggressive users in different conditions. So yeah, it gives us a good time to try to build products that don't just fit the vanilla mold that we've been talking about.
So do you all see derivatives and structured products? Are these just portfolio management tools, or is there something more here? Like, is this something that protocols could bootstrap themselves with from zero to one? Or how do you know, is there something bigger going on with this derivatives revolution in crypto?
Yeah, I don't know if it's as much of like, I mean, the idea of like portfolio management is like insane to unpack. I think if you just like zoom out and think about it, if you're a protocol or you're a traditional company and you're issuing, let's say like ISOs to your employee or some sort of stock option or incentive, you're already interacting with a derivative, right? And this is something that we haven't seen take a lot of like, it hasn't gotten a lot of traction in DeFi yet because people are used to getting paid in token. And those token amounts are usually pretty satisfactory if they can cause the price to go up somehow. But as crypto matures, I think we will start to use options as a form of incentivization. We'll start to approach these like options liquidity mining programs that we're starting to see take off a little bit. And it's going to be tricky to price these things. Like, can't just give your users a bunch of like in the money options every time you mint them as a reward. So I think portfolio management is probably still not like properly unpacked in the sense that it's just a tool to like handle your risk in your book, right? And whoever you are, whatever institution or retail user you are, you just have some risk in your book. So I think that's going to continue to be the biggest use case, is like, how do you balance risk across all of your positions? And we'll see some cool use cases like incentivizing stock options through DeFi services. What else?
Well, to answer your question, I would say that like, yes, like as in any new product or like new innovation in DeFi, like it will definitely have some traction. If only because of the community, like people will be interested in it because it is interesting stuff. Like it's new, it's exciting, and it like allows you. There is like potential like huge like profit to be made. That being said, like I think the community driven like innovations like is not necessarily going to be sustainable for like, the existence of DeFi. Like, at the end of the day, like the financial system exists because like, okay, well either you have exchanging some risks, or like you're investing for a return. You know, and that's kind of the two main reasons, actually, right? And like maybe like speculating as well. But outside those three reasons, like, there's not a ton of reason to be in the financial system. And so we kind of view it as like there's going to be a move along like the use cases of DeFi to something where you're just like, okay, I actually just want to generate, like, I want to have a consistent profit. And like this is what I want from this. And I don't want to participate in DeFi because I believe in like the future here. And I think this is where the highest yields are. So we think we kind of view derivatives as more of like a tool in that. And I wouldn't want to view it as like just for innovation, just because it's interesting, because it's cool. Like, it has to be useful for us to really like consider putting into friction, you know?
Now, there's no live friction token. I know there you have the NFT collection, but is that something on the horizon? Is it something you've given any thought?
Yeah, I mean, we spend a lot of time thinking about it more recently as we just evaluate like kind of what's going on in the market and what we could provide to users with a friction token that we can't, or what users we can unlock with a friction token that we can't get without it. Right now, our focus is really getting to like Vault 6 to 7. As we think about launching some sort of token and incentivizing, not just incentivizing users through it, but also like creating a really useful liquidity network through it. Like, why should, I mean, we're seeing this like right now, it's really challenging for scaled like crypto companies or DeFi protocols particularly to have any meaningful like value, not just capture, but like some value that's added by having the token that's not just the price of the token related. So we think about like tokenomics a bunch. I mean, there's very interesting models that have proven in the short term to work on Ethereum. But yeah, we're focusing on forms of return that aren't emission based. But we're also thinking about incentivizing our power users. So I think, yeah, for people who want to like stay tuned to that, definitely get involved in the Lightning OG community known as the Genesis Wielders and join that chat if you want to catch the latest on friction tokenomics.
Awesome. Yeah, I think it's going to be the most exciting thing is going to be like using these kind of like parts of the friction ecosystem, like I guess like the indicators of value or just like the entities we ascribe value to unlock like different features we're building. That's kind of the most thing I'm most excited about.
Yeah, I mean, we want like people who own parts of friction to be able to access things that others can't or that are like unique benefits to them. And I mean, it's hard to build like meaningful flywheels in DeFi, right? But I think this way is one. And yeah, this is why we really encourage like the DAOs to participate in circuits or like larger institutions who are coming in to earn parts of the network by doing these types of things. So
awesome. That's a nice bit of alpha to close things out on the conversation. But before we do, we'd love to just like give our listeners an opportunity to take action on some of the insights that we've had here. Like, where should they get involved with the community? Where do they find friction? And where do they find the two of you who, by the way, are not Anon founders, completely doxxed. Here they are in the flesh. Tell us where we can find you.
Yeah, you can, our main, we have two big ways we talk to the community. So one is through our Discord. So discord.gg/friction, pretty simple handle there. And then also on Twitter. So our Twitter handle is @friction_labs. Remember, friction with a K. And more recently we launched our forum, which is an open discourse for our community to provide like friction improvement proposals, ideas on tokenomics, revenue streams, grants. So we actually are about to close our first grant to hire if you're looking for interesting roles. So we're actively hiring for senior front-end engineers and Rust developers, as well as DeFi writers, BizOps and sales folks. So all this stuff can be kind of found on our angel list, angel.co/friction, I think, too. And then personal handles.
No. It's like you'll find.
You'll find it if you find the friction on Twitter, I guess. Yeah.
Semi add-on still, I guess.
In the Discord. You can meet me in the Discord. Yeah, we're on the order book.
We're either always on the Discord or the order book. So yeah, find us on one of those two places.
Love it. Thanks a lot, guys. Appreciate
Love
you
it, guys.
On.
Thanks so much for your time.
Aww. Yeah, thank you, guys.
Hey, it's Tom. Our team at Delphi Media just launched a new show, NFT Collector, where two guests go head-to-head to each build a $50,000 NFT portfolio in short 10-minute episodes. They leak alpha all along the way, so click the link in the show notes and subscribe to NFT Collector on YouTube.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to the Delphi podcast. If you enjoyed it, please support the show by hitting subscribe on your podcast app, writing a review, or sharing this episode on Twitter or LinkedIn. Stay tuned for our next episode, out soon.